This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Imagine confronting the person who broke into your house or vandalized your business or murdered your husband. What would you want to know? What would you want to hear? Would it help to see the person who wronged you as an individual? Would it help them if they accepted responsibility for actually hurting a real person? We focus today on restorative justice, programs that facilitate dialogue between victims and offenders in the hope that this process can, first, help the victims, second, the offenders, and perhaps most importantly of all, help us all. Advocates say it tries to rehabilitate criminals who will eventually return to the community. Critics charge it's just a feel-good program that gives cons a new way to game the system. Later, we'll talk with actress Minnie Driver and director Charles Oliver about their new film, Take, which is about crime and forgiveness. But first, if you've been the victim of a crime or a perpetrator, and especially if you've participated on either side of a restorative justice program, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is not an abstract issue for Cheryl Ward Kaiser. Five young men broke into her house one night 16 years ago, sodomized her daughter with a shotgun, and murdered her husband when he tried to intervene. She participated in restorative justice and is now an advocate. She joins us from the studios of KNRY in Monterey, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I guess I have to add that you were there in the room when those crimes happened. The five young men and the young woman who acted as the getaway driver were all arrested and convicted, but obviously for you, it did not end with guilty verdicts.
There's no way that it ever can end. You can't have a crime like that happen, and you put it somewhere. I don't know where that place is that you would put it, but there's no place to put it. So no, it doesn't end that day.
The idea that a verdict and seeing the people hauled away to prison, that's not closure.
Well, no. That word's a word for most of us victims that's absolutely, and here's a terrible even term to use, but it's a trigger word for us, because there is no such thing as closure. It's just the beginning of something is what's happened. I mean, your life begins in a whole different way that day that all happens to you.
Mm-hmm.
So the secret to that is what you do with what happened to you.
So this program, Restorative Justice, did someone approach you with this idea, or did you approach them?
Actually, I wanted to thank the person that had given me the voice in the courtroom, and I found out that that person was the head of corrections and the head of the California Youth Authority, which blew me away. And they were the ones that had put together a law in California which started the laws for all the rest of the nation, and his name was James Rowland. And because of that, I wanted to thank him. And then he asked me to come to a conference. He said, "You said you'd do anything for me." I said, "Yep." And so I went to the conference, and he never said a word to me about what it was. And I came out of that, and I said, "That's what I fought to do from day one." That I now have a word for what I fought to do the entire time I wasn't allowed in the courtroom. I was held in the hallway or in the mm-hmm. district attorney's office. So it was what I fought to do, was to put the victims at the top of the equation.
And in what way is the victim at the top of the equation in this process?
Well, you have much more of a voice in the say-so of what happens. That's the part of the problem that's really hard for victims when you go through the system, is that you don't have a say-so in all of this. With restorative justice, if it's done in the system, and you can do it as a part of the system, you can do it anywhere, anytime in that system, you can approach it as the victim having a thought in what the heck is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So eventually, how long did it take before you actually met with any of the criminals in your case?
The first person I met with, she had been, it had been 7 years since the crime. I met with the girl involved in the crime. She was the getaway driver, and she was in the California Youth Authority. And I knew she was going to get out when she turned 25, so I met her when she was 24.
And what did you want to know from her?
For one thing, I wanted her to have to sit until she actually had ended up pleading guilty, so she'd never heard me even talk about the crime or what had happened in my room. I wanted her to have to listen to me talk about the crime. I wanted her to repeat it back. That's part of the process that they do, which I think is very good for people to have to repeat back what you said. Then I wanted to hear her tell about her crime, and then I had questions for her. I wanted to know why they picked my house. I wanted to know why they singled me out. I didn't have what they wanted. I didn't have a safe. I didn't have the money they wanted. Mm-hmm. Where did they get that from? And I think every victim that's involved in every crime has questions they want answered.
And were you satisfied?
No, she didn't give me the answer. She gave me pieces, but she didn't give me the answer. She said she didn't know.
Do you believe her?
No. I believe she did know, but I believe she's afraid.
Afraid of the other young men who were...
Yeah, there's a lot of fear having to do with she's going to get out what she did.
Mm-hmm.
Her getting out, somebody else deciding to hurt her, somebody else deciding to... The fact that you put that whole realm on, that you take a responsibility for anything else. But she did give me pieces that I didn't have before, so she did at least do that for me.
She also promised to write you a letter every year on the anniversary of the crime.
Right.
And she has not done that. And she's not done that.
No, she wrote me the year she was still in, and then when she got out of, she never wrote me again.
You've not in touch with her at all anymore?
No, I have not talked to her since she got out of prison.
Mm-hmm. What about the young men?
I have talked to the young man that had his foot on my back and the gun to my head. I went and saw him. I actually have gotten to see him twice. Corrections allowed me in behind glass, and then I went in with the Hallmark Channel, and I got to see him face to face.
And was that useful for you?
Oh, it was life-changing. Life-changing for me, and I can say for him, without a doubt.
In what way?
To see him, I knew, you know, when you're involved in a crime, a lot of people don't find out crimes because the people are, they're not there. I was there. Mm-hmm. I knew each player. So I knew he didn't want to be in the room. I knew he wanted out of the room. He could have hurt me really bad because he had his foot on my back, and he didn't. He chose to testify, so he put on a snitch's jacket, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew he was sorry for what he did. He turned around immediately to me in the courtroom and told me that he was sorry. So... when I wrote him, he wrote me back immediately. And so when I saw him and I started talking to him about when he had his foot on my back and the gun to my head, that young man fell to pieces. And for the rest of the hour and a half that we were together, he cried. He did nothing but bawl the entire time we were together. He just kept crying and crying and crying. And I had no doubt watching this young man that he was sorry for what he did. He said, "Who was that monster that was in that room with you?" He said, "How could I have done that to anybody?" And I get a letter from him about once a month, and I'm going to help that young man get out.
So when his parole comes up, you'll testify?
He's supposed to come up in 2009. Of course, the typical California, they've moved it on to 2011. But when he does come up, yeah, I'm going to, and Corrections already knows me, so I have every intention in the world of getting that young man out. He's done what he needed to do in prison. He is not reoffended. He is not a horrible individual. He is learning how to be an electrician. He is doing the things he needs to do, and that's what I really try to encourage him to do. Do everything you can do so that when I get ready to get you out, sweetheart, you had better be perfect because you're going to have to be for me to get you out.
The rapist and the murderer, have you spoken with him?
Got a letter in to the one that killed my husband, and he has written me back, and I actually... It took 4 months for him to write me back, and he said everything in me said I wasn't going to do it, and guess what? He wrote me back. So hopefully we've got, in the next few months, we're going to have an opportunity to sit down together.
Hmm. Let's see if we get some listeners. Let me ask you a question. Have you forgiven any of these people?
Oh, yes. I don't hate any of them, and that's really my reason for going. Partially is to know some answers, but the other part is I do a lot of public speaking, and I want to make sure that they understand that I can tell a public that, but I need to tell them that I don't hate them and that I forgive them. Now, that does not mean I'm letting them out of prison, all of them, but I cannot hate them, and I can set them free in a way that no one else can set them free in a prison.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Scott. Scott with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My question, and it stems from another NPR story and also some personal experience as a victim, but that sometimes, a victim will be able to, a perpetrator will be able to say they're sorry, but if you ask that person to actually feel their feelings, or try to express what they were feeling when they did do the act of whatever they did, they have a real hard time doing that, and they don't want to go into that place to actually talk about why they did it or what they were feeling when they were, doing this terrible thing.
Hmm. Would you agree with that, Cheryl Ward Kaiser?
I think that's the one thing that hasn't happened for them in their lives is that they don't stop to look at themselves. I mean, I think that's that whole That's the whole problem with the system, is there is no vehicle by which they sit down and people talk to them about what their feelings are and why they ended up where they are today, and which is part of the reasons I go talk in prisons. I do victim impact classes, and that's exactly for them to attempt. And you can't ever. I mean, they talk about empathy and putting your feet in someone else's shoes. You know what? You'll never really truly understand that. But for the first time in a long time, a lot of these people have never really understood the harm that they have caused. So a lot of us victims are going into places like that for them to begin to start looking at this, looking at themselves. It's very hard for people that have never been asked to do it, to look at what they did and why they did it.
Scott, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's see if we can quickly go to, this is Chris. Chris with us from Florida.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is for your guest. How can you forgive someone who caused a crime to you?
You know, I only have one answer for this. Of course, I'm Christian, and that's if I'm forgiven, how dare I turn around and say to somebody that I don't forgive? But mine goes deeper. My dad was very abusive to me when I was a kid, and it became a big deal for me in my life. I forgave my father on his deathbed, and that took 40-something years for me to do. And so forgiving these five people, that was not tough compared to forgiving my father. That was the tougher one, and that took 2 years of counseling. And it's really trippy, but it took my dad actually hit me the day before he died. Hmm. And in that hit, it was kind of good because I turned back into the 17-year-old, which is the last time he hit me. And that 17-year-old is really the one that needed to forgive him. And so I was able to turn back into that and literally forgive him on his deathbed, even though he never said he was sorry. And that's a big deal for me. I don't care if people are sorry in this process. I have to do my part. If they do their part, that's their part. I need to make sure that I forgive them. If they're sorry or not is not the issue here for me.
Thank you, Chris. We're going to take a short break. We're talking today about what's known as restorative justice, programs that allow victims to confront their attackers. We'll talk more with Cheryl Ward Kaiser after the break and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the issue of restorative justice. Its admirers argue that allowing victims to confront their attackers offers some resolution for them and some prospect of rehabilitation for the attackers. Critics brush it off as naive. A little later, we'll talk with Minnie Driver. Her new movie touches on some of these issues, on crime and forgiveness. Still with us right now is Cheryl Ward Kaiser. She knows restorative justice firsthand. After being forced to witness her daughter being raped and her husband murdered, she now works as an advocate for victims and offenders. And you're welcome to join the conversation if you've been the victim of a crime or a perpetrator, and especially if you've participated on either side of a restorative justice program. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now is Lisa Ray. She's president of the Justice and Reconciliation Program, an organization dedicated to bringing restorative justice to crime victims, offenders, and to communities torn by crime. She joined us from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And the goal, Cheryl Ward Kaiser talked about some of the goals in terms of from the victim's point of view. There is a larger point of view that I know you're concerned about, and that is for society at large.
Well, yes, and let me say, too, restorative justice is a set of principles that guide reform. And we start, those in the restorative justice movement, which it is, it's a movement in the United States and internationally, and we start with the premise that the criminal justice system is broken, and what can you do to repair it? And it's restorative justice is a vision for reform that puts victims in the center of the system, which Cheryl mentioned, and holds offenders accountable for their crimes. It also sees that the crime is not a crime against the state, but a crime against a real victim in the communities.
And it also points out that most of these individuals are going to eventually return to the same communities where they committed these crimes in the first place.
Exactly right. And it's concerned about recidivism rates, and it's saying, what can we do better? Is incarceration only working in the United States? And the answer to that is no, it's not. And are victims satisfied? And what we're finding nationally, my organization works nationally, and we're finding that victims aren't satisfied with the current criminal justice system. We can do more, and restorative justice guides those reforms that we need.
I think you could find a lot of people who would agree with you that the current system has major flaws in it, to say the least. Nevertheless, is there evidence restorative justice works?
Yes, there is. There are studies around the country and outside the country where restorative justice has been implemented. It's showing that recidivism rates drop, and also that victims are satisfied. And you have to ask that question, you know, how do we measure success in a system? In California, currently, we have 173,000 inmates in California. And last year's budget for corrections was $8.7 billion. Now, I have to ask, in the last 15 years of working in this field, I have to ask, are we safer? Are victims satisfied? And are offenders changing when they come out of the prison system? And I think the answer to that is no. So we have to find a better way.
I'm sure you've heard the criticism, but sharp con can game this, try to get out of prison a little sooner.
You know, that's not true at all. Actually, that's naive, and that's looking at just one part of what restorative justice is. It's not a program. It's a set of principles. Let me give you an example. I ran an in-prison victim-offender project in the state of Texas in 1998. It was called the Sycamore Tree Project. It was in conjunction with Prison Fellowship International. It was a 12-week project that brought surrogates of victims and real offenders together to talk about crime. What it was it was a pilot program for restorative justice. It had incredible results because offenders finally got to see their impact of their crime on a real victim. They could discuss it, as Cheryl talked about. There's power in that. And victims then can actually see what's an offender look like up close. And they can start thinking, do I ever want to meet with my offender? Cheryl took that step, but most people, most victims around the country have not. But they're saying, is there something in it for me? Can I heal in that process? And the answer is, yes, you can. And I think what's critical, too, is that restorative justice needs to be injected into our system across the country with nonviolent offenders, violent offenders, and also in prison and in county jails.
Does this program, is there evidence that it works better? We had a clip of tape at the beginning of the program of, petty crimes, young offenders, vandalism, that sort of thing. You could easily see this working in that context, but with more hardened criminals and more violent crimes, does it work then, too?
Absolutely. Cheryl Ward-Kaiser's story is an example. My organization, the Justice and Reconciliation Project, on our website, there are many stories of victims who have met with their offenders in violent cases like Cheryl's. So at first, when I first started my own work in the restorative justice field in 1992, many were saying, oh, this is just for nonviolent offenders, and also it's probably just for juveniles. You know what? Since that time, around the country and around the world, we've been testing it with violent offenders, we're testing it with juveniles and adults, and it's working on all fronts, and it's being explored on all fronts. Around the world, restorative justice is working. You can see it in the United Kingdom. You can see it in New Zealand. You can see it in Canada. I think the United States is behind the times, and we need to invest in restorative justice because it works. It's going to make us safer. It's cost-effective, and it helps victims, and it changes the perception the view of the offender of himself and of what he did to a human being, a victim.
Let's see if we get some more callers in on the conversation. Let's start with Holly. Holly with us from Ohio.
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to know how her daughter feels about her interaction with these people and if she's involved in the process as well.
Cheryl Ward-Kaiser?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Actually, when I went to see, I was going to see the young man that had his foot on my back when Hallmark did their special. She had consented to go in with me. We just couldn't. They did it so quickly. We couldn't get her cleared in time. It takes because I go talk in the prisons. I'm already cleared. I couldn't get Roxy cleared in time. But Roxy intended to go with me. Yes.
But she's comfortable with this process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she actually is.
You have another daughter who was not home that particular night. She too is happy with this?
No, she probably has had the most anger in all of it. She went with me that day. She didn't get to go in when I did the. The mediation, but she probably would have a harder time and probably needs it more than Roxy and I both do. I think it's harder for the people that aren't involved in the crime. I think sometimes they're the keeper of the gate, and they believe that they have to be angry, and they're the ones that have to carry the whole burden of the whole crime and all this. I really see that as almost a bigger, isn't that terrible? This sounds terrible, huh? That we were better off because we were involved in the crime than she was. I see that for people. I think it's a real stumbling block for them, that they think that that's their role to be, is to be that keeper of that gate. And she has had much harder time with her anger and hatred than Roxy and I both have.
Holly, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to, this is Jason. Jason with us in Boise, Idaho.
Yes, hello. My brother-in-law was killed in a hit-and-run accident on the night of St. Patrick's Day. And for us, the perpetrator has not been yet caught. And at this point in our family, we don't feel there's any animosity or hatred towards the perpetrator. My fear is that when this person, if and when they are caught, that those feelings will change. And I'm curious if being able to speak with them through this mediation, that we'd be able to overcome those.
Lisa Ray, what do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, the benefits of restorative justice is that you are traveling down a road towards healing, and that I think there would be healing in the life of the victim's family, this person on the line, and also the offender would be able to take responsibility for his actions. And that's really what restorative justice opens the doors for.
I was just wondering, can any of these principles be applied before the offender is caught?
Yes, it can. Before they're caught, yes, it could, I guess. It's not usually formally done. But I think part of the problem we have around the country is that there are barriers for restorative justice in terms of it happening at all. Because right now, when a crime occurs, it's a crime against the state, and so it's processed in that way. And as Cheryl had said, you know, it's not about the victim, even though many people think it's, you know, that victims have many rights. They have more rights now than they did. But it's really seen as, okay, we're going to process this crime. Who's guilty? Sentenced? In prison, in jail, that's the end of the story. The victim's out of the equation. So restorative justice needs to be injected early in the process, at every part of the process, even once that person is released back in the community. If they didn't go through some kind of restorative justice process in prison, they need to go through it as they reenter and are reintegrated back into the community.
Jason, good luck. I hope this works out.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's turn to Ashley. Ashley with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I just have to say that I really firmly believe in everything that's been said so far. I've often thought I was abused when I was a little girl by a babysitter, and the only thing that's helped me is I found out that he, too, was abused by his father. And so that bit of information for me was almost a miracle, because it made me think about him and his background and his own pain that caused him to do what he did to me. And so I think, if nothing else, for the victims, just to be able to see why and maybe have some justification as to why someone would do what they do, I think would be really helpful.
Did you ever meet with him, confront him afterwards?
No, I wish that there was something I could do. I think it would be helpful for me, but he, I was older when I remembered and such, so he's not in jail or anything that I know of, so I wish there was some way I could, though.
Yeah, I understand. Ashley, thanks very much. I wonder, Cheryl Ward-Kaiser, would you have any advice for Ashley?
I think it's wonderful that piece of information that she needed to know, and you know what that piece of information told her? That no, that guy wasn't a monster, he was a human being. And that's what is wonderful about what happens in that restorative justice realm. By finding out, I don't care who the person is that's done what they've done to you, they're still a human being. And somehow or other, society has made them into this monster. And we put them in prison, we all wipe our hands, we walk away. It isn't true. And that's what I love about restorative justice. It lets you see the whole truth. And I think for her, I think it would be wonderful. And you never know that there isn't a process that maybe is in her area, that maybe there is a way for her to be able to have an opportunity. And that's what's wonderful about restorative justice, is it's a safe way to confront someone. It's by having that mediator get that other person ready and you ready, and then you put them together in that room, it's amazing what happens. It is. I get to do that in the community that I'm from. We have a restorative justice commission in Monterey County, and I get to do these victim offenders, and I am absolutely blown away. I'll start off thinking, oh my God, this is going to go sideways, and next thing I know, the end, my God, people are up and hugging each other, and I'm like, oh my Lord, look at this. It's just amazing to watch, because people, but we, there's a lot of good in people. There's a lot of good in victims, have this goodness in us. We have that. And it is amazing what can happen when two people look at each other and look in each other's eyes. If we all remember ourselves as children, we remember that your mother drug you down the street, made you confront, made you say you were sorry, did all this stuff. It's the same principle. I mean, why have we gotten away from that and don't believe that that principle still works? This, what happens when you look at someone else in the eyes, it's going to be the toughest thing this shooter ever had to do, was to have to sit down with me. He has no idea of that yet, but it will be the toughest thing he has to do, is walk in that room and look at me face to face. And the system wouldn't let us do it.
We're talking.
Yeah, Neil, can I just interject and just...
I need to say something.
Oh, go ahead.
Excuse me.
Okay.
I just wanted to identify with whom we're speaking. Cheryl Ward-Kaiser, who you just heard, who's a victim of a crime. Also, Lisa Ray, president of the Justice and Reconciliation Program. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Lisa Ray, please go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, there are barriers for restorative justice even happening at all. And so as we're talking about this, you know, I'm thinking of our criminal justice system around the country, and our states across the country. And, you know, we're not doing this. We're doing it in some piecemeal fashion in communities across the country, but we need policies that allow this to happen. And it's not what we are doing, and we need to invest in restorative justice, because it is good for the offender, and it's good for the victim, and it's good for the community.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Gail. Gail with us from Iowa City.
Hi.
Hi.
I mediated hundreds of these cases in California several years ago, and I agree with what your guests are saying in terms of we had much lower recidivism rate, and both victims and offenders reported very positively on their experience. But what I did want to bring up was, at least in the cases we mediated, very often restitution was involved, that the victims had the right to request restitution, and then we worked to come to some kind of agreement about restitution. But given that most of the perpetrators were, or many of them at least, were living in poverty, what we found was that as the months and years rolled on for paying restitution, that initial sense of relief and satisfaction often started turning to resentment over the hardships of restitution. And that's not to say that they weren't willing to be responsible for what they did, but that it raised larger systemic and societal problems about poverty. And so we found that we had to involve a lot of employment opportunities. And we ended up getting into some employment counseling and so on in order to make the whole experience not turn sour for many of the offenders.
Lisa Ray.
Well, I think the bottom line is that the criminal justice system is in need of reform on so many levels. And I've worked in the past as a lobbyist on this subject in the California legislature, and we were very much supporting work programs inside where offenders could earn a decent amount of money so they could pay restitution. And I think, too, with the restorative justice process, you negotiate after dialogue, you ideally would negotiate a kind of contract between victim and the offender.
Yeah, that's how we did it.
Yeah, and so that you work that out. And I mean, I've worked with offenders where they say, well, I can't pay this restitution for, you know, I can't pay it off. It'll take me years. Well, so be it.
Yeah.
I think that's part of, you know, making things right with the victim.
Right. I agree. But
yeah. It has to be realistic.
Yeah, and, you know, so many of our victims, well, I won't go into that. I just wanted to say it's a fine line between that really positive experience and then the years and years that follow up and how many things can go wrong in that time.
Mm. Oh, Gail, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Cheryl Ward Kaiser, I just wanted to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for asking
me. Cheryl Ward Kaiser, who participated in a restorative justice system after witnessing the rape of her daughter and the murder of her husband 16 years ago. Lisa Ray, we're going to continue this conversation after the break. Can I ask you to stay with us?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Please stay with us, and we'll do that. After the break, also, Minnie Driver will join us, along with the writer and director of a new movie called Take. In it, she faces some of these same issues after a violent attack: rage, redemption, and forgiveness. You can join the conversation at 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.